It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Some final thoughts about pass keys and the potential problem with pass keys. Also, a free streaming pen test security course, which begins next week. A lot of listener feedback. And then finally, what is that flaw, the so-called unfixable flaw with Apple's M1? Steve explains the attack and why you probably don't need to worry about it. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 875, recorded Tuesday, June 14th, 2022. The Pac-Man attack. Security Now is brought to you by PlexTrack, the proactive security management platform that helps you focus on winning the right security battles. With PlexTrack, you'll streamline the full workflow from reporting to remediation. Visit PlexTrack.com/TWiT to claim your free month. And by NetFoundry. Apply zero trust to any use case, making cloud easy with a simple user experience while closing all inbound ports. Grab your free swag and free tier now by going to NetFoundry.io/TWiT. And by Thinxt Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/TWiT and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security with this guy right here, the man in charge. Get ready, folks. This show is going to blow your mind. Steve Gibson, you promised me that, right?
We've got a good one today, Leo, for 875. I think that's sort of a good number to have an amazing podcast. Okay, so this week will, I expect, be the last time we talk about pass keys for a while, but not quite yet. Our listeners are still buzzing about it, and some widespread confusion about what Apple presented during their WWDC developers session does need a bit of clarification. But while I was writing that up, I realized, and I'll share, how to best characterize what FIDO is, which we're going to get, with respect to Squirrel, which we're not, but more importantly, what the web often issue is. I mean, like, that's really the big transformative deal that having FIDO on the front end is going to drive, and it's where all the inertia is going to be. Anyway, I also want to turn our listeners on to a free streaming penetration testing security course, which begins Wednesday after next. Then we have a ton of listener feedback, which I've wrapped in additional news. And one listener's question in particular was so intriguing that I'm going to repeat it, but not answer it yet, so that all of our listeners can have a week to contemplate its correct answer.
I love those. All right. I have my pencil poised over my notepad. All right.
It just needed it. I mean, it's like a and although I wasn't looking for it, I also stumbled upon a surprising demonstration proof that we are indeed living in a simulation. And it's broken. That's the point.
Wait a minute.
The
simulation's broken?
Well, reality is.
Oh, okay.
And reality can't be broken unless there's a bug in the simulation. Anyway, when I share it, I think you'll be as convinced as I am. So, you know, kind of maybe we're going to rock everyone's world today.
Let's do it.
Finally, as suggested by this podcast title, which I forgot to mention, is the Pac-Man attack. We're going to take a very deep dive into the past week's headline-capturing news that Apple's famous M1 ARM chips, and presumably the M2s coming soon, all contain a critical bug that cannot be fixed. We'll find out just how bad it is.
Yikes.
And, Leo, I've got the weirdest picture of the week. you can't argue with it, you know, but it's who printed this on a cable?
That's a good question. And I'm seeing it, so I know what you're saying. Well, we'll find out in a moment. Excellent, Steve. Looking forward to it. Our show today brought to you by, oops, I got to push these buttons in the right order here. Ah, there we go. Our show today brought to you by PlexTrack, the purple teaming platform, a proactive cybersecurity management platform for red teams, blue teams, and the teams in between. Are you ready to gain the benefits of purple teaming but have no clue how to get started? Do you even know what purple teaming is? Well, until I met PlexTrack, I didn't, but maybe you do. I think you know what red teams are and blue teams. Are you working to mature your security posture but struggling to optimize efficiency and facilitate collaboration within your team? This is a great solution. And you don't even have to have a purple team. You could have one team that does it all. But still, communication is important. Keeping an eye on the tests you're doing, the checks you're doing, and then on the remediation efforts. PlexTrack is a powerful but simple cybersecurity platform that centralizes all your security assessments, all your pen test reports, all your audit findings, your vulnerability tracking, makes it easy to do all of that. And it transforms the risk management lifecycle because security teams now can generate better reports and they can do it faster. They can aggregate and visualize analytics. They can collaborate. These are all words you want in remediation in real time. It addresses pain points basically across the entire spectrum of security team workflows and roles. So I'll give you an example. There are a number of modules, but I'll give you a few of them so you can understand what PlexTrack can do for you. The reports module does what you'd expect, does reports, but it's second to none because it's designed specifically for reporting security findings. So you can insert easily code samples, screenshots, videos. You can put those into any finding. You can import findings from all your major scanning tools. So you just take that. You can create custom templates so you don't have to repeat over and over again. And you can export to those templates with a click of a button. So really, it's going to streamline your reporting. And frankly, the faster and easier you can do reporting, the better, right? You don't want to waste time at a typewriter. The runbooks module can facilitate your tabletop exercises. It's a runbooks module, right? So it can be in charge of the red team engagements, breach and attack simulations, your purple teaming activities. It improves communication and collaboration. Ultimately, that's really what it comes down to, right? You find the problem, you got to solve the problem. PlexTrack upgrades your program's capabilities by making the most of every team member and every tool. And they love it, too, because it takes off the busy work off their shoulders so they can really do the thing they're there to do, right? There's an analytics module, which helps you visualize your security posture. There's a few reasons why you want to do that. Of course, it makes it easier for you to, grasp it quickly, assess it, prioritize it. It's a much better workflow. You can map risks to frameworks like MITRE ATT&CK and create a risk register. By the way, and when you're reporting to the board or the CISO or the C-level executives, you'll love PlexTrack because your reports are so visual, so clear. They get what you're doing. You get what you're doing. The collaboration is better. Any enterprise security team should absolutely be using PlexTrack to streamline their pen tests, security assessments, incident response reports, to keep red and blue teams focused on getting the real security work done. With PlexTrack, you're going to gain precious time back in your team's day. And as I said, they love it. Their employee morale goes through the roof because it's a time saver for them. PlexTrack enterprise customer Jacobs Engineering. There's a lot of testimonials on the site, but this is one I picked. Deploying PlexTrack allowed our team to cut the reporting cycle by 65%. That's huge. Book a demo today. See how much time PlexTrack can save your team. Try PlexTrack free for 1 month. Really test it out. See how it can improve your effectiveness, improve the efficiency of your security teams. But I got to warn you, when they tried it for a month, they're never going to let it go. They're going to say, no, we're using this. Go to PlexTrack.com/twit to claim the free month, PlexTrack TRAC. Okay. PlexTrack.com/TWIT. Make sure you use that so they know that you saw it on Security Now, and that way Steve gets credit. PlexTrack.com/TWIT. I know sometimes people use Security Now. In this case, use TWIT. That's the one they want to use. And by the way, we thanks PlexTrack so much for supporting Steve and his silly pictures of the week.
So, okay, this is not my fault. I didn't do this.
Not my fault.
Okay, so what we got here is an Ethernet cable, you know, Cat 5 or Cat 6. And it says it's printed, very authentic looking. I mean, I believe that this cable actually has this printed on it. It says, cut here to activate firewall. And then it's got an arrow pointing to a little line. And there you can see an arrow pointing from the other direction where it probably says the same thing. Cut here to activate firewall. Telling you that, yeah. I mean, it just must be somebody who is making cable with a great sense of humor who said, okay, we'll just put something funny on it.
He's not wrong.
No, and the person who sent this to me used a big red rectangle to highlight that phrase. Unfortunately, it overlays the top level domain. I can see www.
We want to know where you get this, don't we?
Yes, yes. I'm like, okay, where, what? So I can't sell. I can't see what the top level domain is. It's www.bit.something. Looks like maybe an N something, or I don't know. I mean, I think the shortest TLD is two characters, so I think we're missing.
Maybe NL? B-I-T? NL? That's Netherlands, right?
That feels like...
This feels like a Dutch joke.
It does.
Cut here to activate firewall.
Yeah.
And anyway, I love it because they give you a line and arrows pointing at the line. So just in case you're concerned about where you're cutting, you know exactly.
Yeah, well, because you wouldn't want to cut like in the middle of one of those words.
No,
cut at the right spot. Who knows what would happen?
It's got to be made up. Don't you think it's made up?
I mean, the whole picture was like faked? It's pretty good.
All right, I'm going to go to bit.nl and I'll find out for you. If I can order them, I'm getting you a whole roll. We'll call it the Security Now. Oh, yeah. You know what? It's a data center, bit.nl. It's in Dutch, but a data center's network managed hosting in the cloud. So I think they did this as a joke. I love it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So I heard from many different listeners that during the WWDC developer presentation on passkeys, Apple talked about synchronizing keys. So I listened carefully to the entire presentation. For anyone who's interested, the 34-minute presentation video is this week's GRC shortcut of the week. So that means it's https://grc.sc/875. As I said, it's about a 34-minute presentation, 33, 34. And I believe that what these people thought they heard was Apple addressing the need for, or thought that what they heard, you know, being Apple addressing the need for the type of synchronization we talked about last week, syncing apps across non-Apple ecosystems like Android and Windows, is not what happened. I found no mention of anything like that anywhere in the presentation, nor is it anywhere in the developer docs, which I've also linked to in the show notes for anybody who wants to jump right to it. The types of passkey sharing Apple supports is first and foremost using the iCloud keychain, of course, to dynamically synchronize keys, these passkeys, across an individual user's Apple ecosystem. So, as we know, all Apple devices thus will remain synchronized. The other form of sharing Apple described uses AirDrop to pass logon credentials to another user. An AirDrop can also be used to permanently pass a passkey to someone else for some site or service, permanently adding it to their keychain to use from then on. So that's sort of like explicit, here's my passkey. You can now use it to log on as me. But so far, from everything I've seen, Apple has in no way suggested that they will ever be synchronizing passkeys with external non-Apple platforms. You know, nothing's been said so far either way. They haven't said they're not going to, but nobody seems to have asked that question, and it was not part of the developer presentation. But Apple's example solution of using AirDrop to send a passkey to another person's iDevice, you know, like, you know, a friend of yours, a spouse, a child, a sibling, who, you know, whatever, for their subsequent use, highlighted something that I think is important to understand. And this is where, in thinking about it, I realized what really makes Squirrel different from Fido and why. Squirrel is a complete solution for secure remote logon, whereas Fido, and, you know, technically Fido 2 with its passkeys, is a replacement for usernames and passwords. The two are not the same. For example, take the case of giving someone else access to a site. If you give them your passkey, which is Apple's solution demonstrated during the developer presentation, then they are now you on that site in every meaningful way. When they authenticate, it's you authenticating, because they're using your passkey. It's the exact equivalent of you giving them your username and password. And since they are you, they can see your settings, your private details, everything that you can see and do when you log in using that same passkey. And since they are you, they're presumably also able to change the passkey to lock you out. And they can presumably pass it along to others. Unless Apple has realized that secondary passkey sharing is a really bad idea and should be blocked, which would technically be possible. Well, I don't know either way.
This is what the situation we're in right now. When Lisa needs the login to our Comcast account, I just send her my password and login. She doesn't have a separate one because it's the same account. So that's the standard. Does Squirrel solve that with some sort of shared access?
Uh-huh.
No. Well,
of course.
How could it? Because Comcast only has one login for my account.
Okay. So, I don't know either way whether they're going to block secondary passkey sharing. In any event, when you voluntarily give your passkey to someone else, your site access has now escaped your control. And I agree with you, Leo. It's exactly the same thing. We solved this with Squirrel. If you want to allow someone to share some access to an account as a guest, for example, sharing a Netflix account, you obtain a one-time invitation token from the site and provide it to them. When they attempt to log into the site with their own Squirrel ID, the site doesn't know them. So it prompts them to create a new account or to use an outstanding invitation if they have one. Their use of the invitation identifies them to the site as a guest of yours, enabling them to subsequently log into your account using their Squirrel ID. Since they're using their Squirrel ID, and we just sold a copy of Spinrite 6. Thank you, woo-hoo, if you're a listener. Since they're using their Squirrel ID and guests are unable to request invitations for others, you, as the account owner, retain control. And you're able to rescind their guest access status at any time, which isn't possible otherwise. I mean, like in traditional username and password sharing. And all this scales seamlessly to enterprise use when hundreds of users might need to share access to common resources. It's called managed shared access, and it's part of the Squirrel solution. solution. It's already there. We have an online demo with the entire solution working, and its operation is fully worked out and specified. And needless to say, there's a lot more to Squirrel. So as it stands, the FIDO2 passkey system is without question more secure than usernames and passwords. No doubt about it, it's definitely superior. But the FIDO designers were crypto people working to solve one small part of the much larger problem of practical, real-world user authentication. They didn't think the whole problem through because that was never their charter. They could credibly say it wasn't their job. It wasn't. But even in a FIDO2 passkeys world, that job still needs to be done. Squirrel does it. But unfortunately, FIDO and passkeys does not do it. Unfortunately, this means that instead of being as revolutionary as it could have been, we get another half-baked solution. It's way better than what came before, but it missed the opportunity, which comes along so rarely, to address the practical needs of and really solve the network authentication problem. Rather than the true breakthrough that Squirrel's adoption would have meant, we're going to get incremental progress. It's definitely progress. But because it wasn't really thought through as an entire solution, FIDO is basically a crypto hack. It also brings a whole new set of problems. If FIDO is to be our solution, we really do need some form of centralized passkey storage and synchronization, not only within a vendor, but also across vendors. Last week, someone calling themselves Captain Jack Zeno mentioned at SGGRC in a tweet to someone else. So it appeared in my Twitter feed. Captain Jack wrote to this other person, "You may be excited about passkeys, but Squirrel was carefully developed over 7 years by at SGGRC and solves problems you may not even realize you'd have." And he said he mentioned potentially cross-platform portability. And yeah, we, as we know, Squirrel does that, and it does so much more. Someone tweeting as Dr. Nathan P. Gibson, I guess that's, I mean, that's his Twitter handle, said, "Hi, Steve. Loved your detailed breakdown of passkey. You mentioned waiting for password managers to start providing sync services for these FIDO2 private keys. I see that LastPass seems to be promising something, quote, later this year, unquote." And then he has a link to the blog. He says, "Do you know anything more about when this syncing might be coming to a password manager near me?" And so I saw LastPass's blog post last Monday the 6th. It was a bit confusing. And I mean, I spent some time trying to figure out what they were saying, because they were at the same time also promoting the new use of what they called no more passwords today. And what I understand is that apparently that's by the use of their own LastPass authenticator, which would use the biometrics present on a handset. Thus, you could unlock your LastPass vault without using a master password. Okay, so not that big an announcement. But separate from that immediate announcement was indeed a forward-looking statement of their intention to support FIDO2 passkeys. So that's not today, but at least one major password manager is taking aim at this problem. And if one does, they'll all need to. So I suspect that the biggest effect of Apple's, Google's, and Microsoft's support may be to induce websites to bring up their own support for WebAuthN, which is what's necessary on the back end. And so let's talk for a minute.
By the way, that's what about 1Password says they're going to do, is support AuthN.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So that's the way to do it, right? Is
yes.
And then presumably there'd be an export-import feature from 1Password Manager or iCloud, I would hope.
I would. Well, yes. Now, it'll be really interesting to see whether Apple allows a wholesale export.
Well, they say they are. They say there's an export feature, yeah?
No.
They didn't say that.
They No, they said there's a passkey sharing, which is different. You use AirDrop to send one key to a phone.
I know that's not the same. But somebody told me. You've watched the presentation.
I watched the presentation. I read the developer docs. There's not a word about export.
Okay.
And if I'm wrong, listeners, please correct me. I'd much rather it be true that they're going to allow export than just, you know, be a curmudgeon and say, well, I didn't get it right. So, you know, if anyone finds that there's an export of passkeys from iLand, I want to know. Okay, so WebAuthn. The heavy lift that Fido will face and that Squirrel would have faced was the need for back-end web server support. As we know, it's surprising, always surprising, how slowly things change. No question about it, it's going to take years. It's going to take all of the major web server platforms to build it in, then for all of the existing web servers to be upgraded to support it, and then to do whatever they need to do on their end to actually, you know, give it a database and enable it and, you know, have the lights on. And since it's not clear that there's a huge benefit to them, since things are sort of working as is, I think we can expect it's going to take a while. Think about how long it took for the log on with Facebook and log on with Google, OAuth kludge, to finally become popular. And it's still far from universal. You know, it's around. You encounter it, but you certainly can't use it everywhere. What you can use everywhere is the original fill out the form username and password. The reason password managers were an overnight hit was that they provided an entirely client-side solution which did not require any back-end change to websites. Web servers didn't know or care how a user was arranging to provide their username and password, and they didn't need to care. But make no mistake, automated form fill of username and password is and has always been a horrific kludge. The fact that kludges mostly work doesn't make them any less kludgy. WebAuthn finally and at long last changes that. The adoption of WebAuthn, which was approved and formalized by the W3C consortium 3 years ago, back in 2019, represents a massive and long-needed update to username and password authentication. As I mentioned last week, Fido and Squirrel work essentially the same way. They both give a web server a public key. The web server generates a random nonce, which it sends to the browser. The browser, holding the matching private key, which it never releases, signs and returns that nonce to the web server. And the web server uses the public key that it has on file to verify the returned signature. What WebAuthn is and does is provide all of the mechanics, definitions, protocols, specifications, and implementations of that new form of interchange between a web server and a web client. Now, we're likely going to be facing a chicken and egg situation for some time. You know, what kind of got lost amid the ballyhoo of Apple's announcement last Monday is the fact that you can't use it anywhere. I mean, it's like having Squirrel, like which we've had for years now, but you can't actually log in anywhere but GRC and, you know, a
Twitter
couple of
community
our...
also. You can use your Squirrel there. I think you can. Oh. Well, I set it up, and then remember one of your guys in the forums was providing a back-end server because you need a back-end server for Squirrel, right?
Some sort of authentication thing. I don't have one on any of my implementations, but you certainly could. You could federate the authentication.
There was something going on that I couldn't do that he was doing, and then he let that slide, and so people were using Squirrel to log into twit.community, couldn't use it, and then he said, "Oh yeah, let me see if I can get." I don't know. I haven't kept up on that.
And it just sort of died.
Yeah, just sort of died out. Yeah.
So,
but I needed something, some piece that he was providing.
Well, thank you for trying, Leo. It will be good that Apple and Google and Microsoft will all be supporting passkeys, which is to say FIDO2 on the client side and WebAuthn on the protocol back-end server side. That's the glue that makes this possible. But when iOS 16 arrives with its built-in passkey support, you'll probably only be able to log in to Apple.com, Google.com, and maybe Microsoft.com due to the heavy lift of change that will be required on the back end. But WebAuthn is the key, period. It provides a complete replacement for the insecure mess of usernames and passwords that we've been living since the dawn of man. And interestingly, WebAuthn optionally supports Squirrel's Chosen 255-19 elliptic curve.
Yay.
With its special properties that allow for non-random deterministic private key synthesis. That's the key behind Squirrel, as I've mentioned, if you'll pardon the pun. So it might be possible someday in the future. I'm not going to do it. We got a bunch of Squirrel developers now. They'll do this to transparently run a modified Squirrel solution to use Squirrel-style deterministic passkeys on the server infrastructure that FIDO built. So that would be cool. And, you know, perhaps indeed the only kind of progress that can practically be made today in today's world is incremental. So the fact that everyone's excited and it's going to be available in our clients, and when web servers start adding Authn support, their UI, their login UI will show, hey, if you've got a passkey, use it. And, you know, so you'll give them the first time you'll log in as you using old school login, then you'll have your client generate a passkey, which they'll hold on to, and you could then use that to log in the future. But the other point I wanted to make was that what I really did with Squirrel, and this is exactly to the point you were making with you and Lisa, is, you know, I didn't just stop at replacing usernames and passwords. I solved the whole problem. I mean, as you heard me say back then, every single question anybody could ask about what if this, what if that, but what this, but blah, 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 you know, I have Squirrel solved the problem. And provided all kinds of forward-looking solutions that would be handy to have. We're not going to get it yet. Maybe we'll get it eventually.
Yeah, I realized that Discourse, which is the forum software I use, Zenforo, you don't have to do anything. I think it's built in. But Discourse has to use an OAuth 2 provider. So Jose C. Gomez, who was, I think it's probably still around in your forums, had set up a Squirrel OAuth 2
provider.
That's
very clever.
At Squirrel OAuth.
Basically an OAuth gateway for
exactly.
Squirrel.
But he doesn't, it's gone. It's a 502 bad gateway. So
Bad gateway.
So unfortunately, everybody who used Squirrel to set up an account on Twitter community, I guess, is out of luck. So sorry, I apologize. If you know, I don't know enough to run an OAuth 2 server myself. So,
well, and I've moved on. So I did what I could, and we'll get little pieces of Squirrel over time.
This is not perfect, but you know, the perfect can be the enemy of the good, and passkey is much better than what we're doing right now. So
my only argument is that making a change on the back end requires everybody to make the change.
Right.
And it's such a heavy lift that if we were going to make a change, let's make it a good one. I mean, let's make it one that actually solves all these other use cases for which people are like, you know, sharing passwords and what if a bad guy did get a hold of your key and then were able to use it to lock you out of an account. That doesn't work with Squirrel. Some person who gets your Squirrel identity cannot lock you out of accounts where you are registered with Squirrel. There's so much there But, you know, and that's where the time went. But, you know, I got it out of my system. Now I'm going to spin right.
What do you know what the lift is? Well, you must, because you've watched this video now. How hard it would be. Let's say I wanted to implement passkeys on a site.
So no mortal will do that.
It's that hard.
Yeah. It'll be a library. For example, yeah. I googled FIDO2 passkeys IIS. You know, obviously Microsoft server, zero hits. Oh. There's nothing for Microsoft's web server.
So just with Squirrel, Zen 4.0 supported Squirrel, so it was easy for you to implement. Discourse does not. It requires an OAuth 2 backend.
Actually, Zen 4.0 did not support Squirrel.
But somebody that wrote something.
That was Rasmus Vind, our wonderful PHP guy who
hacked Zen 4.0 to do that.
Yeah, well, actually, Zen 4.0 has a beautiful add-ons architecture. So he was literally able to create an add-on that any Zen 4.0 user, any Zen 4.0 site could just do it. And, of course, none have because what's a squirrel?
Well, reliant. I'm just as I am with Discourse. I would be reliant on Discourse adding that capability. And somebody's using WordPress, they would need a plug-in. The good news is that the web is mostly dominated by a handful of servers.
Very few servers, and they will all get web off end plugins or modules in the Apache case, for example. And so you just, you know, add the web off end module and configure it, and you're probably good to go.
Yeah, right. Well, that day I hope comes soon.
It'll be interesting to see. It's not, and this is the problem, is, you know, there was a benefit to Google and Facebook doing the login with Google, login with Facebook OAuth hack, because as we know, they track you as you pass by. You know, they know who you are and where you're logging in. So this federated OAuth login is, you know, they had a benefit. They had a reason for doing it. It's not clear to me what the benefit will be to web servers and websites adding passkeys. You know, things are working the way they are now. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as I said, not everybody is doing the log on with Google and Facebook. You know, you certainly can't use it universally. You see it here and there, and it's kind of like being able to buy something with PayPal. It's like, oh, good, I could use that here. Yeah. But other places, oh, you need my credit card number.
WordPress does have a Squirrel plugin. Did that get a lot of uptake?
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah.
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 I think that's got to be key. You got to have those easy
switches. Yes. It's got to be a drop-in solution.
Yep.
So last Wednesday, a company known as Offensive Security, who are the people behind Kali Linux, announced that they'd be live streaming their penetration testing with Kali Linux course sessions on Twitch later this month. I mention this because a subset of the course's material, all of the streamed content, will be open to the public on Twitch at no charge. And I felt sure that some of our listeners would find that interesting. For those who don't know, Kali Linux is a Debian-based Linux distro, which is targeted toward facilitating information security tasks such as penetration testing, security research, computer forensics, and reverse engineering. The course in question, Pen 200, is a paid course which helps students prepare for the Offensive Security Certified Professional, OSCP, certification exam. Before the pandemic, it was only available in person, but during the COVID response, live training was suspended and Offensive Security moved their courseware online for remote instruction. So today, a 26-part, 13-week, twice-weekly, hour-long per event online course will be offered to prepare students for the OSCP certification. Non-enrolled viewers are welcome to audit the course. You, of course, won't get any credit for it, but there's the information. There's an FAQ in the show notes, which details or a link to the FAQ in the show notes, which details everything you'll need to get going. I grabbed the two most relevant Q&As from that page. First one is, where and when will it be happening? And their answer is the OFSEC live streaming sessions are currently planned to start June 22nd, 2022. So that's Wednesday after next at from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern. So that's currently 9 to 10 West Coast, and run through December 7th, 2022. So pretty much the rest of the year. The OFSEC Live Penn 200 streaming sessions will consist of twice weekly, hour-long interactive presentations. They said we'll also be streaming a weekly office hour where we will address any questions a student may have regarding the Penn 200 course and prior streaming sessions. And those, I would imagine, will be only for enrolled people. And how much will it cost? And they said the OFSEC Live Penn 200 Twitch streaming sessions will be free and open to the public. So just a heads up for our listeners. Before I introduce the proof that we are living in a simulation, I did want to mention that Surfshark has followed ExpressVPN in pulling out of India. I heard Andy mention on Mac Break Weekly that he logs in to a VPN in India.
Yes.
Oh, Alex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he can watch the Pittsburgh Steelers football game.
Yes. And the good news is, as I mentioned last week, and at least in the case of ExpressVPN, you can still get an IP from India,
right,
even though it's being hosted in some other country.
Very clever little shenanigans they must be pulling there.
Yep, a hack.
Yeah.
And Leah, let's take our second break, and then the proof that we're living in a simulated reality.
Okay, officially the best tease in the history of all time.
You cannot unknow this, be careful. This is going to change things.
Well, I remember I went to see the movie The Matrix without any prior knowledge, right?
Oh.
And I go in, I watch it, I come out. My eyes are like this because I think, oh, my God, I'm in a simulation because that's the whole premise. I have to say my life was never the same since. So I'm ready. Are we going to take the blue pill here or the red pill?
Once upon a time, the fact that Elon agreed with us had some value, not so much anymore.
No.
No one really cares what he thinks.
Get ready. Your red pill moment is coming up. But first, a word from NetFoundry. Our show today brought to you by NetFoundry, a game-changing open source security tool for you. Every week, you know, you listen to this show, it's like a minefield of ransomware and hacking. And it all really comes down to just the inability to secure resources on your network, right? Because networks are insecure, period. It's kind of their goal is to let everybody in. So NetFoundry is designed, you know, it's zero trust. It's designed to make an inherently insecure concept secure. It's built on an open source tool that many of you may know. It's fantastic, called OpenZD. They built it, and they open sourced it. God bless them. It makes moving to the cloud easy peasy. It gives a simple user experience for remote access. Without a VPN, we're not talking a VPN here. It allows you to connect IoT and Edge in minutes. It's entirely zero trust. That's the idea. That's the principle. NetFoundry gives your application superpowers, end-to-end encryption, private DNS, dark services, and more. You'll stop DDoS attacks. You'll end brute force attacks, credential stuffing. Got no home here. Those CVE, you know, 0 days we talk about all the time, forget it. No 10 out of 10 is going to bother you because it closes all inbound ports. You know about that from Steve. Stealths it. This is port knocking on steroids, deployable in minutes. OpenZD, created and maintained by NetFoundry, provides an open source, free, and easy way for the world to embed zero trust networking into anything. It's a library, basically. It provides everything you need to spin up a truly private, zero-trust overlay network in minutes across anything. You could do it in your app. You could do it on any device, on any cloud. It's extensible. It's flexible. It's scalable. And it's open source, so you can use it for free if you want. Using OpenZD isolates your apps and systems so they cannot be subject to external network-level attacks from malicious actors, while protecting from internal, even OS networks, such as being immune to network side-channel attacks like phishing. It's zero trust across all networks, entirely. Which, you know, you don't have to worry about expensive and risky reactive patching. Agnostic design patterns mean you only need commodity internet with outbound ports without needing network engineering skills to implement it. You can say goodbye to complex firewall rules, inbound ports, public DNS, static network access controls. You say goodbye to VPNs. It's really the holy grail of security, right? You just assume that your internal network is open, so somebody has to authenticate before they can use an app or a network or any host. It can be embedded into any app, host, or network. They've recently embedded private zero-trust networking right into Prometheus, which, after Kubernetes, is the second most cloud-native compute foundation project. You can kind of say goodbye to that tug-of-war between developers and security. Developers want it to be open, right? Security says, But look, zero trust is a journey. You can start wherever you need to start based on your priorities. OpenZD, it's numerous SDKs, a variety of tunneling apps for popular OSs and edge routers. You could find them in the cloud marketplace for, you know, many of these OSs. If you don't want to host OpenZD, don't worry. You don't have to. NetFoundry has a SaaS solution, which includes, by the way, you might say, oh, now I know how they make their money. Nope. Includes free forever tiers. Free forever tiers for up to 10 endpoints. Yeah, and if you have more than 10 endpoints, okay, you can work out a deal with NetFoundry. They're really a great company. Their support of OpenZD is a great model for open source software. We've talked about Spring for Shell, that Windows RPC remote exploit, RCE. The recommendation, of course, and you should do this to patch now, but with OpenZD, you don't have any inbound ports at all. So no external network attack even can see you. You can get basically, you could patch at your own convenience. You're still safe, right? That's an example. This is a big concept, a big subject, and there is a lot to this, and it's really mind-bogglingly good. I want you to go to NetFoundry, NetFoundry. They're at netfoundry.io/twit. Get some free swag. I have my OpenZD little macaroni sticker on my laptop. Learn more. Get started. NetFoundry.io/twit. Get your free swag and your free tier right now. That's what I love about this. You can try it free forever and really get a sense of it. But I think you'll be very impressed. OpenZD. I want to put in a big plug for it. It is the way to do zero trust. OpenZD is at NetFoundry.io/twit. Okay, I'm ready to have my mind blown. I'm taking the red pill, Steve. Go ahead.
So, I stumbled upon a proof that we are indeed living in a simulation. My proof that we're in a simulation is that I've identified a clear and incontrovertible bug that exists within the simulation itself.
A glitch.
Yes. It's a bug. Because it defies reality, which is, after all, what the simulation is intended to simulate.
Yeah.
And what makes this so compelling is that all of us are aware of this bug. But we all just shrug it off without it ever occurring to us that that is what it is. So here's the bug.
I'm ready to have my mind blown. Okay.
It's a clear failure in the rules of probability. If the rules of probability were being properly simulated, when you attempt to plug in one of those original USB-A style rectangular plugs, the plug's orientation would be wrong only half the time.
Yeah.
But we all know that it's not 50-50. Everyone's experience is that the first time we attempt to plug in one of those, it is almost always wrong.
Always.
Always. Isn't it? It
yes.
is.
Yes.
Leo, it is always wrong. It cannot be always wrong, but it is.
I have the Leo Laporte corollary to that. The toast always falls butter side down.
Well, see?
I
think the more we think about this, the more we're going to realize things are not all as they seem.
You got me.
I mean, right? I mean, isn't one of those GD USBs always wrong?
Always upside down. Yep.
Yes. It should be 50-50. It must be 50-50, and it is not. No one's experience is that it's 50-50. So we've been given a clue that we've not been paying attention to.
It's a glitch in the matrix. You found it.
It's a bug.
Yep.
It's a bug in probability, yep. And that must mean that there's a failure in the simulation.
That's why cats always land on their feet.
Now, Leo, I have something that may be of interest to you. I stumbled upon a valid use for facial recognition.
Okay.
It's in the show notes. It's the smart pet door. The other day, I encountered an absolutely valid and very clever application for facial recognition, which I doubt that anyone would have a problem with, unlike recognizing people. The bad news is that it's called Petvation, which has just got to be about the worst name that anyone has ever come up with. Yeah. Petvation. My God. I'm sure there must be a wonderful name for such a product. Hopefully some listener will think of it and tell these poor Kickstarter people. So what is it? Though you'd never know it from the name, it's a little automated doggy door or cat door, which employs facial recognition of the household canine or feline.
Now, see, so, you're not a pet owner, so I know that you don't know how serious the need is for this. We have a pet door, and we actually had to chip our cats so that the pet door, when they get close, it uses RFID, and it goes and opens. Because otherwise, raccoons, turkeys, vultures, wolves.
Ducks. I've heard about apparently ducks.
Anything could use that portal.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But so, I would love the face recognition. That'd be great.
Isn't that great? So
yeah.
It's an automated doggy door or cat door, employs this facial recognition. As they approach the door, their identities are verified, and only if they are known to it will it raise the barrier and allow them to pass. You know, it's brilliant. The text, which accompanies this horribly named but otherwise wonderful-looking innovation, notes that, quote, it can also recognize the most common unwanted guests, raccoon, wolf slash coyote, bear, deer.
Bear?
How big is that dog door? Yeah. Squirrel, rabbit, duck, boar, skunk, fox, rats, boar, snake, chickens, and more, and deny them entry to your home. It's unclear to me in reading that description why explicit recognition of unwanted pets is important if it's truly being discriminating about the identity of the family's pet.
Sure. Well, and, you don't want to let the neighbor's cat in. I mean,
well, what if you did have a pet duck? I mean, that's probably happened.
That's a good point.
So, you probably have to turn off the duck eliminator. But in any event, perhaps that's just, to make sure that nothing unwanted can get in, even if it's, like some clever animal wearing a dog mask to spoof the identity of your pooch.
But really, I think maybe I'm biased, but I think a lot of dogs look alike and a lot of cats look alike.
Yeah.
Can you really do this accurately?
I don't know.
I'm sending this to Lisa.
And you're right. That chipping animals is a solution.
Perfect.
Give them a little short range RFID.
Exactly.
I should note that I stumbled upon this over on Kickstarter when I was following up on a recent communication from Ed Cano. That was Ed's 48th communication.
Wow.
Ed is the originator of the Sand Sara, which you and I are still waiting for, Leo.
Oh.
It may finally actually ship. Actually, apparently it has shipped, and they're working their way through customs at the moment.
What is it? It's been so long, I forgot.
I know. The Sand Sara, for those who don't recall, is a nifty-looking tabletop bed of fine-grained sand through which a steel ball bearing is rolled by a magnet located underneath the bed.
Oh, yeah, I remember
the magnet.
This. Yeah.
And I've got the link to it in the show notes. If you want to click on it, you'll see some animated reminders. The magnet is moved by a pair of stepper motors using a quite ingenious mechanism. This podcast discovered this Kickstarter project back in March of 2020, just as COVID was descending upon the world. Ed's original timeline anticipated fulfillment during August that same year. So it appears that it'll finally be happening just shy of 2 years late.
Yeah, that's pretty par for the course, unfortunately, with this stuff.
But I have no complaint with Ed's approach. His communication has been good and consistent, and boy, is he a man after my own heart. He's proven himself to be an absolute perfectionist.
He should be. He raised 18 million Mexican dollars.
Yes, he has 2,000 supporters, 2,000 backers.
Yeah.
Though it appears that we'll be receiving this nifty-looking gadget nearly 2 years late, it really does appear that what we'll be receiving will have been well worth the wait. As I mentioned, his project has just shy of 2,000 backers, and I know that many of them are among our listeners since Ed told me so. When we discovered this, we got quite excited at the time, so our collective wait may finally be nearing an end.
What is 18 million pesos in American money?
I don't know. It was a couple hundred bucks, I think.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Each.
It's expensive. He says 19 pesos to the dollar. So, yeah, that's right. They're about a nickel each. So, he raised a lot of money.
Yeah, well,
it's 20 million nickels worth to you.
He didn't run out of money. Apparently, he pulled this thing off, and you know, I thought of it because Lori just think she will love this. It's just, you know, it's like the perfect thing. And he's worked on making it quiet because it was like you could hear the stepping motors buzzing, and
yeah,
so no, not
quiet.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And like these beautiful round wood. He just went through like fire in order to get this thing done, but. They're shipping. So I just wanted to mention that. And that's how I found Petvation, the worst named thing ever. The engineering looks good, but boy, they're not much for marketing.
Yeah, by the way, it's $874,000. It's a lot of money he raised. So good.
Yeah,
I'm glad he didn't run with it.
Nope.
Good
he
for
did
you,
not.
Ed.
He is a good guy. And if he were to do something else, I wouldn't put it on my calendar, but I'd probably give him more money because, you know, he does come through.
Yeah.
Okay, we got some closing the loop feedback from our listeners, a bunch of interesting stuff. Robert Wicks, who tweeted from Bert Wicks, he said, "You called it, Steve. This just popped up on my ancient i7 4770 system that has no TPM." And he sent me a screenshot. It says, "Windows update. Windows 11 version 22H2 is ready and it's free. Get the latest version of pinch your nose. Get the latest version of Windows with," and it says, and then there's under it's a link you can click, "a new look, new features, and enhanced
wow.
security," because we always say that. And
it's
then
a
there's
fourth
a button
generation for, i7. So it's not just a TPM. This is definitely ineligible.
Yeah, it's system. It's got like smoke signals coming off of it. So Peter G. Chase also tweeted from @PChaseG. He said, "Ha ha, my only slightly ineligible for Win 11 upgrade PC processor is now magically eligible, and Windows is pestering me to do it. Nothing changed on my end. Must be them. You said they might miraculously change the requirements, but I still don't want Windows 11. Okay, so what happened? Leo, under the category of you just can't make this stuff up, we have the explanation for what Robert and Peter and many others experienced last week. The Verge covered the story last Thursday under the unbelievable headline, well, if it weren't Microsoft, it'd be unbelievable, "Microsoft has accidentally released Windows 11 for unsupported PCs."
Well, thank you, and Microsoft.
It runs just fine.
Thanks so very much.
Oh, paraphrasing from what The Verge wrote, they said, Microsoft released the final version of its next big Windows 11 update, 22H2, to release preview testers on Tuesday and accidentally made it available to PCs that are not officially supported. Oops. They actually wrote oops, not me. Twitter and Reddit users were quick to spot the mistake, with hundreds of Windows insiders able to upgrade their Windows 10 machines on older CPUs. Microsoft, as we know, has strict minimum hardware requirements for Windows 11, leaving millions of PCs behind, so the mistake will once again highlight the company's controversial upgrade policy, which is to say that it runs just fine everywhere, even though we don't want to give it to you. So they said Windows 11 officially requires Intel 8th gen Coffee Lake or Zen 2 CPUs and later, with very few exceptions. While there are easy ways to install Windows 11 on unsupported CPUs, Microsoft doesn't even let its Windows insiders officially install beta builds of the operating system on unsupported PCs. So this mistaken release is rather unusual. Microsoft is aware of the mistake and it's investigating. Oh, well, that's comforting. Quote, says Microsoft, it's a bug and the right team is investigating it, unquote. As opposed to having the wrong team investigate it, which would just add insult to injury, presumably. And that is what Microsoft's official Windows Insider Twitter account tweeted. So if you manage to install Windows 11 on an unsupported PC and we're expecting only release preview updates for Windows 10, you should be able to roll back the unexpected upgrade in the settings section of Windows 11, said The Verge. So anyway, got a kick out of that one. And speaking of large numbers, Jeff Parrish, tweeting from at KB9GXK, sounds like he's might be a ham, don't you think? Is that a ham designation, KB9GXK? Or is that to be K9 or something?
I don't know.
He says, you can go to math.tools/calculator/num... and I didn't get the rest of the link, to convert that number. Remember, the number was, I don't even remember now, 2 to the 768 from last week. It was three sets of 256-bit encryptions.
It was big, yes.
Well, he says, it's large, just the first couple of numbers, and then he lists them. But somebody else sent me the entire thing. Of course, we have that kind of listener.
I am not reading this. Are you going to read this?
No. But I'm going to go up from the bottom.
Okay.
Because I stumbled on something that was sort of interesting.
Yeah.
So it ends in 38.
Yes.
Then we have 52,000. Then we have 139,611,000,000, 696,000,000,000, 116,000,000,000,000. Okay. Then we have 17 quintillion. I guess I am reading it. 886 sextillion.
He's so good, he's reading it backwards, folks.
In high heels. Yes. 256 septillion. 555 octillion.
This is all Latin. 500, sept, oct, known. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and what happened was later I got to sept, oct, and nov. And it's, wait a minute, those are months, September, October, November.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we got nonillion, then we got decillion, then we have undecillion, then duodecillion, tredecillion, quattrodecillion. These are not very imaginative at this point. Quindecillion. Well,
that's why
sextillion.
It's orderly, so you can figure it out.
Sependecillion.
Right? Yeah.
18. Oh, then we have octodecillion, and finally, oh no, then
novemdecillion.
Novemdecillion.
Yeah.
And finally, virgintillion.
Vigintillion.
Vigintillion.
That's because that's 20. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, thank you. Those of you who followed up on the 2 to the 768, We will never forget ye.
And Gumby, I think, told us he tried to do it in Emacs and it quit at quadrillion. What a wimp. So never mind Emacs.
So Roy Ben Yosef tweeting at Lizard, at Wizard Lizard Roy as his Twitter handle. He was able to out. That one wasn't free when he went for it. He said, "Hi, Steve. Just heard your piece on the New South Wales driver's license. And maybe I'm missing something, but isn't it all client side? They can do all sorts of fancy crypto and whatnot. Can't I just write my own app that looks the same with, you know, a dancing flower and shows whatever I want? Is there no or shouldn't be server side variation somehow?" He says, "Longtime listener since 2011. You got me into the cybersecurity business since 2012.
Wonderful.
Thank you." And I'll follow that immediately with Ryan's tweet because he's his company's PKI expert. Ryan tweeted, actually he sent via email, grc.com/feedback. It was in the mailbag. "Hello, Steve. Regarding the New South Wales digital driver's license, I work as my company's PKI expert." And we know that's, you know, public key infrastructure.
There's a job called PKI expert.
Oh, yeah. We're in, and he knows all about web authn, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, "I liked your solution to the DDL problem." You know, I talked about how you could just solve this with a certificate. He said, "I wanted to let you know that your proposed PKI-based solution can also prevent spoofing of the driver's license QR code. Dancing flowers are all well and good, but could be spoofed if you were motivated enough, as our previous writer noted." He said, "The way to prevent copying the QR code and passing it off as your own lies in exactly the type of certificate that you issue. If you issued a signed DDL certificate like you suggested, with the key usage attribute of digital signature," he said, parens, "and the enhanced key usage attribute of email protection, then your DDL can sign arbitrary messages. This is how encrypted S/MIME email works. In our case, the DDL, the digital driver's license, could sign your name and age and include the signature in the QR code." In other words, he came up with a very clever extension. The certificate that is the DDL itself could be used for signing. So that QR code could constantly be changing locally on the screen. Each of those changes dynamically refreshed and signed by the certificate, which is the DDL because it's a cert. So the point is, that's a very clever extension of the idea. He said, "But couldn't this QR code be copied?" He says, "Well, the next step is to have the person verifying the ID check the timestamp to see exactly when the QR code was signed. You could have the user push a button or enter a PIN in the app." And I had it just doing it automatically because you could do that too. This also lets you customize your trust. A police officer's scanning device could trust a QR code for 30 seconds. A bouncer's device could trust a QR code for 1 to 2 minutes. So you can pull up your QR code while you're in line and keep the line moving. He really thought this through. The chances of being able to predict the exact 30, 60, or 120-second window that you'll need to produce the QR code means that setting the clock ahead on your friend's phone and pre-generating a QR code are vanishingly small. Live long and prosper, Ryan. So, Ryan, very nice piece of work on that.
Yeah.
Tom Davies was a little grumbly. He said, "It always grates me a bit when you dunk on GDPR for ruining browsing," unquote. "Please have a look here." And he sent me to www.coventry.ac.uk. He says, "As you can see, it's perfectly possible to be GDPR compliant, only forcing a single interaction on the user. What has ruined browsing," he has again in quotes, "is not GDPR, but web hosts' reliance on tracking users to the point where they would rather ruin your browsing experience than allow you to opt out." He says, I've not dug into it that much, but I'm sure we've all seen examples where it's clear that sites are deliberately making it extremely difficult to do anything other than accept the default please track me option. It really seems that if you don't want to be tracked, these sites do not want you to visit. So I was curious to see what Tom was referring to. And Leo, you brought it up. So I went over there. What Tom means, because we have a bar at the bottom with three options. What Tom means is that it's possible for a website to request to set a cookie in order to no longer need to notify about setting cookies. Okay. And just for the record, since Tom says this is grating on him, we've previously made it clear that the strict privacy regulations that had been in place long before the GDPR, but that everyone was happily ignoring, thus no annoying cookie warning banners, until the GDPR was enacted to give those regulations some teeth. I certainly don't disagree with the bias toward tracking that Tom has, but it really was the enacting of the GDPR that's what is making our lives miserable, because now it's not just a regulation everyone ignores. It's, you know, something that everyone has to pay attention to.
Well, and it's what it really is. The problem, in my opinion, is this notion that all cookies are bad.
Right.
My site uses one cookie. A cookie to remember your preferences between light and dark mode. But because it uses one cookie, it's not tracking you. It's just remember you're saving on your computer, your setting.
Right.
Your That's preferences. All it's doing.
Yeah.
Because it's doing that, I have to put up a stupid ass cookie thing. And I think it's wrong and it's absurd. And it has the exact opposite effect. By inuring people to these messages, it's making them forget about it. It's just like, yeah, click. How many quadrillion, ventillion useless clicks have there been?
Clicks.
Waste of resources, because that has to be transmitted. No, it's a perfect example of a misguided law that accomplishes exactly the opposite of its intent. By the way, pat on the back, because today Firefox announced what should have been the case all along, that third-party cookies are entirely blocked. They're going to sandbox all cookies unless the originating site is asking for it.
By default, yes.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is third-party cookies. First-party cookies are not problematic, I would submit. In any event, certainly my light-dark mode cookie is not problematic.
No.
It's incredibly infuriating, and maybe that our mentions of this grates on you, but that ain't nothing compared to how these cookie warnings grate on every other person in the globe, because we have to do it because the EU decided to do it. It damaged the EU's credibility beyond belief. It's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
It had all sorts of negative effects. It makes the EU a laughingstock. Thank you.
Yeah. Philip Lirich, he said regarding last week's podcast, SN874, the only essential diff between passkeys and Squirrel is that Squirrel uses computed private keys. So could Squirrel be made to register its private key with a FIDO2 website and respond to a FIDO2 auth challenge? Then Squirrel would work on any FIDO2 site. He said in parens, but... please finish Spinrite first.
Yes.
So he anticipated what I talked about at the top of this episode. The use of deterministic private keys may be possible under WebAuthn. So if so, then yes, Squirrel's single key approach could transparently replace the big bucket of keys approach that is used by FIDO without sacrificing any security. And as we now more know, you know, there is, in fact, much more to Squirrel than just the difference between one master key that synthesizes passkeys on the fly versus randomly generated passkeys, all of which you have to store. As I demonstrated at the top of the podcast, Squirrel really goes all the way to solving authentication. What we have with passkeys in FIDO2 is a very robust replacement of usernames and passwords. So definite improvement there. And as for Spinrite, everyone should know that I'm done with Squirrel.
What?
Except for talking about it here. I've handed it off and over to a very competent group of developers who know it now just as well as I do, and they hang out over at squirrel.grc.com. So no one need worry for a nanosecond that I will again become distracted by Squirrel. That's not going to happen. And somebody with a clever handle, Lintux, L-Y-N-T-U-X, Lintux, he said, I wanted to remind you at SGGRC that a YubiKey can only hold up to 25 credentials each. That's not a problem since there aren't that many FIDO2 websites out there, but that could change. That's another reason why Squirrel is better. And in fact, you know, the fact that YubiKeys have a 25 credential limit also beautifully demonstrates that the FIDO's project's work was never aimed at mass use and adoption. They were originally focused upon using super secure hardware dongles for authentication to just a few crucial sites. That system was never able to scale. So when it failed to get off the ground, they relaxed their requirements and produced FIDO2. I'm going to skip one because
Yeah, it's my fault we started late.
No, it's okay. Yeah. I guess the way I pronounce his name, Juho Vitasalo. He said, hi. I tried the latest.
I'm pretty sure that's not how you pronounce it, but it's going to have to do.
Sorry about that. I'll just say that his Twitter handle is at JUHOV.
Yeah, so, that's easier. Yeah.
I tried the latest Spinrite XE from your dev directory, but could not run it in Windows 7. I was hoping to burn an ISO that way. I have a failing SSD I need to massage. Can you tell me how to use these executables you have on your server?
Oh,
thanks.
Boy.
Yeah, and Greg got a bunch of email from our listeners. So I'm sure that he's referring to the reference we recently made to grc.com/dev/spinrite. And I asked you, and you did, to pull up the directory listing just to sort of show how much work we did on this first phase of Spinrite. That directory contains a gazillion incremental Spinrite development releases, but they are DOS executables, not Windows exes. So they definitely will not run under Windows. But moreover, even if you did run them under DOS, they do not yet move the user past the system inventory stage where Spinrite is figuring out what you've got and how it can best work with it. That's where all of our collective work thus far has focused. Once I do have something that's operational, all existing Spinrite licensees will be able to obtain their own copies from GRC's server. But we're not quite at that stage yet, so I apologize for the confusion.
I'm guessing Juho thought he'd found a source of free Spinrite, which this is not.
Maybe, although he was expecting to burn an ISO and the normal Spinrite that you run on Windows will do that. So it sounds like he has some understanding of the way it normally works.
Right.
Okay.
Could you use the old Spinrite for an SSD? Yeah, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
If anyone listening to this podcast has only been like paying half attention, although this has been so great, I don't know how that's possible. Now is the time to bring your entire focus to bear on this next question, our final question from a listener, because it wins the award for the best question maybe ever. And I'm going to leave it hanging and unanswered until next week. So everyone will have the opportunity this next week to ponder the question and its answer. And Leo and everyone in the Discord and chat rooms, please resist the temptation to blurt out any spoilers for everyone else who wants to ponder this very intriguing question. Here it is. Eric Osterholm, he tweeted, "Hi, Steve. Longtime listener. I'm a little confused on the key length discussion. I always thought that encrypting twice merely doubled the effective strength. Here's my reasoning. Imagine you have an algorithm and a key that you can fully brute force in one day. If you add one bit to the key, you double the key space, and therefore it takes twice as long to brute force, parens, or 2 days. If you instead encrypt twice, then it takes 1 day to decrypt the outer ciphertext, at which point you get back to the first output of ciphertext. Then, in one more day, you can brute force the first inner ciphertext. Like in the first example, this takes 2 days. It seems to me that these are equivalent. Is there something I'm missing? So there it is. Everybody think about that. And we'll answer the question at the top of next week's show.
His logic seems sound.
It seems very sound. So okay. No spoilers, anybody. No. Don't blurt it out.
Nope.
Just smile if you think you got it.
I ain't going to blurt it out because I don't know it. You're safe with me, Steve.
So let's take our last break, and we're going to delve into the so-called Pac-Man attack, which leverages an unpatchable and unfixable flaw which exists across Apple's custom M1 chipset family.
Sigh. I'm going to talk about our sponsor today. I've talked about them before. It's what we started with, honeypots. This, my friends, this little doohickey is a honeypot sitting on our network. Yeah, you say it looks like, you know, a little hard drive maybe, just like a little plastic enclosure with some circuitry. Yeah, I notice you say it's attached to your network and it's plugged in. That's a honeypot? Oh, yeah. Because to the bad guy, the hacker who's penetrated my network, this doesn't look like, you know, a hard drive. This looks like a network-attached storage. In fact, I've set it up to look exactly like my Synology. It's got the MAC address. It's got the login. It's all the details a hacker would say, oh, yeah, and maybe even try to log into it. But the minute the bad guy does, I get a notification saying, hey, somebody just tried to log in to this non-existent Synology you have. Could be a SCADA device. Could be a Windows server. Could be a Linux server. Could be a Christmas tree with 100 services lit up. Could have just a select few services. It could be almost anything you want. It's the easy to set up honeypot. You use your Thinkst Canary console to set up, you know, whatever device it is. You can change it anytime you want. Well, there's another cool thing you can do with this Thinkst Canary. It will let you create Canary tokens, which look, for all intents and purposes, like PDFs or Word documents or Excel spreadsheets. They're not, but, you know, you can spread them around your network. I might have one. I just might. Sitting on my hard drive saying something like employee payroll information. Now, if you're a bad guy, again, you're wandering around, you're looking at stuff, you might say, boy, that's a spreadsheet I'd like to download. But the minute they touch it, the minute they try to open it, the minute they do anything with it, it immediately pings me through my Canary and lets me know there's someone in the network. It's unfortunate, but companies almost always find out too late that they've been compromised. And, you know, you can spend millions on perimeter security, but if somebody gets in, how are you going to know? On average, it takes 191 days. What is that? It's more than 6 months for companies, on average, to realize there's somebody in their network. But with a Canary or two or three spread around your network, it's like little tripwires just waiting for the bad guys. It's really a clever idea. I know many companies now that have adopted this. Some of the biggest companies in the world have hundreds of them. Even small companies might have five or six at critical access points. You can put them on Active Directory. So if an attacker browses Active Directory for file servers or explores file shares, they'll be looking for documents. They'll be trying default passwords against network devices and web services. They'll scan for open services. Bing! This thing, it doesn't look vulnerable. It looks valuable. This thing pops up.
It can look like a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, a Windows server. Attackers won't even know they've been caught. They'll just say, well, I guess that password didn't work. But you know. Canary tokens, same thing. You can put an infinite number if you want. There's an unlimited number of Canary tokens you can make with your Canaries. It's designed to be simple. In fact, Canary is based on the work that the company's founders did, training other companies, militaries, even governments on how to break into networks. And it's with their knowledge about how attackers work that they built Canary. You can change its configuration anytime you want in minutes. And you know, the best part is they just sit there quietly on the network. You know, if you don't hear from them, all is well. But if something bad happens, you're going to get it, not swamped by false alarms, but a message that's very clear that tells you exactly what's going on. And you can get any way you want. Emails, text message. You're going to get a console when you get your Canaries. You can just check that. It works with Slack. In fact, it works with webhooks, so it works with a whole bunch of stuff. Syslog. There's even an API if you want a kind of custom interface. I think Canaries are one of the best tools against data breaches. You've got your perimeter defenses. You need those, but you also need somebody on the inside keeping an eye out for you, watching, because there's nothing worse than getting that email from an intruder who says, yeah, we just triggered ransomware, and oh, by the way, we've been on your network for months, exfiltrated 18 terabytes worth of customer records, employee records, and that new movie you're about to release. You'll know before that happens. Now, how much do they cost? Well, it depends what you're going to get. I'll give you an example. Go to canary.tools/twit, canary.tools/twit. Let's say you want five of them, because that's reasonable. Small business, you might put them around different places in the network. $7,500 a year for five. You can get more or fewer if you want. Of course, as I mentioned, you get your own hosted console. You get upgrades, support, maintenance for a year. You sit on it, you break it, whatever. They'll send you a new one, no questions asked. You can take 10% off that if you use the word twit in the how did you hear about us box. That helps us because then they know you saw it here. But it also helps you 10% off. And that's, by the way, not just for the first year. That's forever. That's for life. And if you're at all worried, we know you're going to love this Canary. But if you're at all unhappy, you've got a 2-month money-back guarantee. So there really is no risk. canary.tools/twit, canary, canary, like the canary in the coal mine, get it? canary.tools/twit. Enter the code twit, T-W-I-T, in the how did you hear about us box to claim your 10% off for life. These are just brilliant. If you're not running this, what is your plan when somebody gets in and they're wandering around and you don't know? Because you know what? You're not going to see them. It's not like some stranger in the hall. Who are you? No, they're sneaky. canary.tools/twit. We thank them so much for creating a great device and for supporting Security Now. Okay, Steve, let's move on.
By far, the biggest headline-grabbing news this past week was the teaser that Apple's much-vaunted M1 chips contain a critical bug or bugs that cannot be patched or repaired. First of all, only part of that is true. The reason Apple is being singled out is that their M1 ARM architecture chips are the first to use a cool new feature of the ARM version 8.3 architecture known as pointer authentication. Everyone else plans to use it too. They just haven't gotten their newest chips out yet. The heading of the 14-page research paper published by four researchers at the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory reads, "Pac-Man, Attacking ARM Pointer Authentication with Speculative Execution." So, once again, we have the specter, pun intended, of speculative execution raising its ever-ugly head, this time in a new context. A new feature of the ARM version 8.3 architecture initially represented by Apple's proprietary M1 chip. Okay, so what is it? Pac-Man is a novel hardware attack that can bypass the benefits of an emerging feature known as pointer authentication. PAC, PAC. So that's where the PAC comes from, Pac-Man. The authors of this work present the following three contributions they feel. First, a new way of thinking about compounding threat models in the Spectre age, meaning hardware and software, not only one or the other. Second, reverse engineering details of the M1 memory hierarchy. There's almost nothing available publicly from Apple, so they had to just figure it out the hard way to pull this off in practice. And three, a hardware attack to forge kernel packs, that is kernel pointer authentications, from user space on M1. They wrote, Pac-Man is what you get when you mix a hardware mitigation for software attacks with micro-architectural side channels. We believe the core idea of Pac-Man will be applicable to much more than just Pac. So these guys believe that they've uncovered another entire class of exploitable micro-architectural flaws, which are introduced by attempts to mitigate software attacks. We'll talk about pointer authentication and what it is in detail in a second. But here's what the researchers wrote for the summary abstract at the top of their paper. They said, this paper studies the synergies between memory corruption vulnerabilities and speculative execution vulnerabilities. We leverage speculative execution attacks to bypass an important memory protection mechanism, ARM pointer authentication, a security feature that is used to enforce pointer integrity. We present Pac-Man, a novel attack methodology that speculatively leaks PAC verification results via, and I'll be explaining all this in a second, via micro-architectural side channels without causing any crashes. Our attack removes the primary barrier to conducting control flow hijacking attacks on a platform protected using pointer authentication. In other words, you know, pointers are what the system uses to, well, obviously to point to things, but for example, to control its flow of control. So if you're able to change the pointers and not have that change detected, then you're back where you were, being able to, without this protection, obviously, being able to, if you're able to get down into the kernel, to do things. So they said, we demonstrate multiple proof of concept attacks of Pac-Man on the Apple M1 SoC, you know, system on a chip, the first desktop processor that supports ARM pointer authentication. We reverse engineer the TLB, the translation look-aside buffer, which is the way memory is organized these days, on the Apple M1 SoC, and expand micro-architectural side channel attacks to Apple processors, meaning, you know, before it had been Intel stuff, right? So now Apple. Moreover, we show that the Pac-Man attack works across privilege levels, meaning that we can attack the operating system kernel as an unprivileged user in user space. And I loved how they set this up and framed this work in their paper's short introduction, so I want to share it too, just two paragraphs. They said, modern systems are becoming increasingly complex, exposing a large attack surface with vulnerabilities in both software and hardware. In the software layer, memory corruption vulnerabilities, such as buffer overflows, can be exploited by attackers to alter the behavior or take full control of a victim program. In the hardware layer, micro-architectural side-channel vulnerabilities, such as Spectre and Meltdown, can be exploited to leak arbitrary data within the victim program's address space. Today, it is common for security researchers to explore software and hardware vulnerabilities separately, considering the two vulnerabilities in two disjoint threat models. In this paper, we study the synergies between memory corruption vulnerabilities and micro-architectural side-channel vulnerabilities. we show how a hardware attack can be used to assist a software attack to bypass a strong security defense mechanism. Specifically, we demonstrate that by leveraging speculative execution attacks, an attacker can bypass an important software security primitive called ARM pointer authentication to conduct a control flow hijacking attack. Okay, so what is ARM pointer authentication? We've talked, and Leo was just talking about canaries, right? We've talked about related attack mitigation measures in the past. Remember stack cookies. They're a form of canary. The idea with stack cookies is that the system places little bits of unpredictable crypto hashes on the stack as a means for detecting when a buffer overrun has just occurred. So before executing a return from a subroutine, which is when the overwritten attack code would get executed, the bit of code performing the return first checks the stack for the proper cookie, the proper canary, and only executes the return if the value found at the location matches what's expected. The idea is that attackers don't have nearly sufficient visibility into the system to know what the cookie should be. So their attempt to overrun a buffer on the stack is inherently somewhat brute force, you know, kind of a blunderbuss approach. The cookie allows their overwriting to be proactively detected before the contents of the stack is trusted and acted upon. What the ARM version 8.3 architecture introduces is a clever means of adding a tiny authentication hash. Actually, it can be too tiny, as it turns out. We'll get there in a second. Adding a tiny authentication hash into ARM pointers as a means for detecting any unauthorized changes to that pointer. As we know, the ARM architecture is 64 bits wide. That means that it will have 64-bit pointers. But 64 bits is, I can't even pronounce this number. It's a virgintillion. Yes. It's 1-844-744-0737-09-551-616.
It's a big number.
That's how many 64 bits gives you. Said another way, it's, get this, 18.446 billion gigabytes of pointer space. 18.446 billion gigabytes of pointer space in 64 bits. Since no one has nearly that much RAM in 2022, you know, we'll see what happens 10 years from now. That means that a large number of the high order bits of 64-bit ARM memory pointers are always going to be zero. So the clever ARM engineers realized that they could set a boundary point in their pointers. To the right of the boundary is a valid pointer, which is able to address as much memory as the system has. And to the left of the boundary, using all of the bits, the high order bits, which are always going to be zero because the system doesn't have enough memory for them to ever come into use, those can now be cleverly used to validate the bits on the right. Here's how the MIT guys described this. They said memory corruption vulnerabilities pose a significant security threat to modern systems. You know, right, we're talking about that pretty much all the time on this podcast. They said these vulnerabilities are caused by software bugs which allow an attacker to corrupt the content of a memory location. The corrupted memory content containing important data structures such as code and data pointers can then be used by the attacker to hijack the control flow of the victim program. Well-studied control flow hijacking techniques include return-oriented programming, ROP, which we've discussed at length in the past, and jump-oriented programming, JOP. In 2017, ARM introduced pointer authentication, PA for short, into ARMv 8.3 as a security feature to protect pointer integrity. Since 2018, pointer authentication has been supported in Apple processors, including multiple generations of mobile processors and the recent M1, M1 Pro, and M1 Max chips. Multiple chip manufacturers, including ARM, Qualcomm, and Samsung, have either announced or are expected to ship new processors supporting pointer authentication. In a nutshell, they wrote, pointer authentication is currently being used to protect many systems and is projected to be even more widely adopted in the upcoming years. Pointer authentication makes it significantly more difficult for an attacker to modify protected pointers in memory without detection. Pointer authentication protects a pointer with a cryptographic hash. This hash verifies that the pointer has not been modified, and it's called a pointer authentication code, or PAC for short. Okay, so this is really clever. It essentially makes 64-bit pointers self-authenticating, such that any change to any of the pointer's 64 bits will trigger a protection fault and cause the operating system to immediately terminate the offending program. The Achilles heel of this approach is that there are not a large number of authentication bits available. In the case of Mac OS version 12.2.1, which extravagantly uses 48 of the total 64 bits for valid pointers, only 16 bits remain available for the authentication role. As we know, 16 bits is a famous number. It's 64K. That's the total number of possible combinations that can be taken by any 16-bit value. Again, here's what the researchers describe. They said, considering that the actual address space in a 64-bit architecture is usually less than 64 bits, less than that 18 billion gigabytes. For example, 48 bits on Mac OS 12.2.1 or 12.2.1 on M1, they said, pointer authentication stores the pointer authentication code, the PAC, together with the pointer in these unused bits. Whenever a protected pointer is used, the integrity of the pointer is verified by validating the PAC using the pointer value. Use of a pointer with an incorrect PAC will cause the program to crash. With pointer authentication in place, an attacker who wants to modify a pointer must correctly guess or infer the matching PAC of the pointer after they've modified it. Depending on the system configuration, the size of the PAC, which ranges from 11 to 31 bits, may be small enough to be brute forced. However, simple brute forcing approaches cannot break pointer authentication. The reason is that every time an incorrect PAC is used, the event results in a victim program crash. Restarting a program after a crash results in changed PACs, as the PACs are computed from renewed secret keys every time the program runs. Moreover, frequent crashes can be easily captured by anomaly detection tools. The breakthrough that these guys achieved was finding a way to successfully brute force probe for the proper authentication code given a modified pointer. By doing that, they're able to make up their own PAC for whatever pointer value they need. So the final piece of description I'll share from their paper is the Pac-Man attack. In this paper, we propose the Pac-Man attack, which extends speculative execution attacks to bypass pointer authentication by constructing a pack oracle. Given a pointer in a victim execution context, a pack oracle could be used to precisely distinguish between a correct pack and an incorrect one without causing any crashes. In other words, exactly what's needed for brute forcing. They said, we further show that with such a pack oracle, the attacker can brute force the correct pack value while suppressing crashes and construct a control flow hijacking attack on a pointer authentication enabled victim program or operating system. The key insight, they said, of our Pac-Man attack is to use speculative execution to stealthily leak pack verification results via microarchitectural side channels. Our attack works relying on Pac-Man gadgets. A Pac-Man gadget consists of two operations. First, a pointer verification operation that speculatively verifies the correctness or not, typically, of a guessed pack. And two, a transmission operation that speculatively transmits the verification result via a microarchitectural side channel. So these guys have gotten very clever. But then bad guys are too. The pointer verification operation is performed by an authentication instruction, one of the new instructions introduced in ARM version 8.3, which outputs a valid pointer if the verification succeeds and an invalid pointer otherwise. The transmission operation can be performed by a memory load store instruction or branch instruction taking the output of the pointer as an address. If a correct pack is guessed, the transmission operation will speculatively access a valid pointer, resulting in observable microarchitectural side effects. Otherwise, the transmission step will cause a speculative execution due to accessing an invalid pointer. They said, note that we execute both operations on a misspeculated path. Thus, the two operations will not trigger architecture visible events. God, that's clever. Avoiding the use where valid guesses result in crashes. So they've basically taken the what we've learned in the last few years about microarchitectural side effects. The idea that subtle variations in branches taken and not taken can be sensed across process because they're left in the hardware so that everyone shares, and you're not going to cause a crash because they're deliberately arranging that these tests occur in the speculation path, which the processor never executes. So the side effects are generated by the speculation portion of the engine, which is executing ahead of where the processor is actually going. The processor doesn't take that path, so no mistake no crash occurs, no exception fault is triggered. Yet it still leaves a trace, a footprint in the microarchitecture, which they're able to sense. This is so cool. Okay, so now we bottom line it. What does all this actually mean for those relying upon the security of Apple's M1-based devices? In their own FAQ, the researchers provide some reality check answers. Does this attack require physical access? They ask themselves. No. We actually did all our experiments over the network on a machine in another room. Pac-Man works just fine remotely even if you have unprivileged code execution. Should I be worried? As long as you keep your software up to date, no. Pac-Man is an exploitation technique. On its own, it cannot compromise your system. While the hardware mechanisms used by Pac-Man cannot be patched with software features, memory corruption bugs can be. Can I tell if someone is using Pac-Man against me? They replied, much like the Spectre attack our work is based on, Pac-Man executes entirely in the speculative regime and leaves no logs, so probably not. They ask, why do you need a software bug to do the Pac-Man attack? And they answer, Pac-Man takes an existing software bug, a memory rewrite, and turns it into a more powerful primitive, pointer authentication bypass. For our demo, we add our own bug to the kernel using our own kernel module. In a real-world attack, you would just find an existing kernel bug. Our demo only uses the kernel extension for adding a software bug. The entire attack runs in user space. So an attacker with an existing bug could do the same attack without the extension that their proof of concept provides. Finally, is Pac-Man being used in the wild? And they reply, to our knowledge, no. Now, Apple's response didn't offer much. They officially said, quote, we want to thank the researchers for their collaboration as this proof of concept advances our understanding of these techniques. Yeah, I bet. Based on our analysis, as well as the details shared with us by the researchers, we have concluded this issue does not pose an immediate risk to our users and is insufficient to bypass device protections on its own. Okay, that was carefully worded to be exactly factually correct. And it is. Generally speaking, the common M1 chip user does not have anything to worry about more, you know, after this than they did before. But the authors never suggested that this could be used in any form of standalone attack. What this does mean is that successful attacks against current and future ARM chips equipped with pointer authentication will need to be more complex in order to also defeat this new extra layer of protection. Because the protection is there and it's good, but the attacks are going to have to be more complex to defeat it, and they can. As is, Apple's M1 chips based on the ARM version 8.3 architecture are thus significantly more difficult to successfully attack than other systems which lack this additional, though imperfect, layer of protection. And I'll close with this observation. Apple's allocation of 48 bits for their pointers, which affords access to more than 250,000 gigabytes of RAM, is obviously excessive in the extreme. Before this paper was published, Apple's engineers probably thought, what the hell? We have 64 bits of pointer space, so we'll use the lower 48 for pointing and the upper 16 for pointer authentication. Assuming at the time that it was not possible to brute force probe for the correct value of those 16 spare bits, Apple's engineers likely thought that there would only be one chance in 65536 of an attacker correctly guessing the proper hash for a modified pointer. And a wrong guess, the first wrong guess, any wrong guess, would cause the victim program to be immediately terminated. But we know that 16 bits, now we know that 16 bits is not sufficient. So Apple could choose to significantly strengthen their pointer authentication by tightening down on the active pointer space, maybe even setting it up dynamically based upon the amount of RAM a system actually contains. A large system, even a large system, with 64 gigabytes of RAM requires pointers to consume only 36 bits lets you address 64 gig of RAM. That leaves 28 bits for authentication, which is 4,096 times more difficult and time-consuming to brute force, with no other overhead or cost to the system. In any event, the sky is once again not falling, and all is well.
Good. Now, but could it fall in the future?
Well, you know, when you consider that every time we attempt to plug in a USB plug, it fails, it could be that the attacker will guess right the first time.
Yes, it could be.
Even though they've got one chance in 65536. I mean, I've never plugged in a USB plug correctly the first time. It never happens.
Never happens.
Which demonstrates, like that black cat, remember, that kind of flickered? Two cats walked by the Matrix, and that represented a glitch in the Matrix?
Yeah.
We got a glitch here. You know, the best thing about USB Type-C is that, you know, this may actually be an attempt to cover up this bug.
It's hiding the glitch. I think
yes.
You're right.
Now it doesn't matter. You'll get it right the first time, every time.
So
and
they
with
say,
time, with time, those old type A connectors, mm-hmm. they'll fade away. Mm-hmm. And this bug in reality that was made it very possible. I mean, someone is thinking, boy, those humans are dumb. Look at them. Every time they try to plug in those USB things,
they never notice.
You know, we can't change the code in the simulation now. It's running. We cannot patch it on the fly. So we just have to put up with this bug in USB type A connectors. But now those are going to fade into the past. We're going to get type C, and nobody will even know.
Oh, see? Brilliant. Brilliant. That Matrix, it knows what it's doing. Well, thanks for joining us on the Red Pill edition of Security Now. Mr. Steve Gibson lives at SGGRC on the Twitter if you want to leave him a DM. He also has a little website he calls GRC.com, the Gibson Research Corporation. What he's researching right now, SpinRite 6.1. SpinRite 6 is current, world's best mass storage maintenance and recovery utility. 6.1 is imminent. And if you buy 6.0 now, you'll get 6.1 when it comes out. You can also participate in the development of 6.1. You can also find this show there. He has a couple of unique versions, a 16 kilobit audio version. Why don't you do 8-bit? Why not just go all the way? 4-bit audio.
We would call that the Minecraft edition.
Yeah, 8-bit audio. 16-bit audio, which is smaller, obviously, than the normal 64 kilobit audio. He also has transcripts, which are actually very handy for searching and reading. And, of course, the 64 kilobit audio, the standard version. That's all at grc.com. While you're there, check out all the wonderful goodies Steve makes available to you for free. And, of course, his bread and butter, SpinRite. We have audio and video on our website, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel with a video dedicated to Security Now. Just search YouTube for Security Now. You'll also be able to subscribe because it's a podcast. As soon as we're done editing this thing, cleaning it all up, polishing it up, we'll put it out on the internets, and you can get it just by subscribing in your favorite podcast player. If your podcast player has ratings, leave us a 5-star, would you? Let the world know. Everybody needs to know.
I mean, this was clearly a 5-star episode.
Come I don't on. Know how you can get any better than this one. But we'll find out next week. That's for sure. We do the show every Tuesday. We try to do it around 1:30 Pacific. If Leo isn't a laggard and slug, 1:30 to 2, something like that, Pacific. 1:30 is 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. The live streams are live.twit.tv. There are chat rooms. The IRC chat room is free and open to all at irc.twit.tv. If you prefer Discord, join the club. Club Twit gives you access to the very fancy Club Twit Discord, plus ad-free versions of this show and all the other shows, plus the Twit Plus feed, which has material that we don't put in the podcasts, like the secrets of the universe. Oh, no, wait a minute. That was in the podcast. All of that, $7 a month. I think that's a fair price to pay. It sure helps us. For instance, just to give you an idea, we've got to update Drupal because that's what runs our back end. That's the websites running on it. The API runs on it. And it's an old version of Drupal, which is going to go out of support next year. We don't want to have an insecure version of Drupal sitting there. It's a cool $250,000. But we're saving up for it using the money from ClubTwit. It's that kind of thing that really helps us out. So if you want to help out, twit.tv/ClubTwit. I will be back here next week. I know you will too, Steve, for episode 876. More revelations. The truth
and the
is
answer
out there.
To the answer to the big question, why is double encrypting not only twice as strong, but exponentially as strong?
It takes one day to do the outer shell, one day to do the inner shell. It should take
seems
the same
right
amount.
To me.
She'd be one plus one, right?
What seems, do you what, seems do, what are right
the
to me.
What do the boffins say? One times one?
No, it would be 2 to the 256 times
a lot better.
Stronger. Way better.
Why is
be
that?
Like summing the keys, like having a 512-bit key instead of a 257-bit key. I know.
That's a head scratcher.
I know.
Oh, get to work on that. And do you want people to DM you with their thoughts?
They could certainly DM me. Those are private.
So don't do it public.
That won't be a giveaway to anyone. Yeah. And we'll answer the question next week.
All right. Good stuff. Thanks, Steve. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Righto. Bye.
If you are looking for a midweek update on the week's tech news, I got to tell you, you got to check out Tech News Weekly. See, it's all kind of built in there with the title. You get to learn about the news in tech that matters. Every Thursday, Jason Howell and I talk to the people making and breaking the tech news, get their insights and their interesting stories. It's a great show to check out. twit.tv/TNW. Security now.